Érettségi vizsga angol nyelvből. Hallott szöveg értése emelt szint.
Welcome to the listening component of the mature examination. The listening material and the instructions are recorded on this CD, and the tasks and instructions are printed in your text booklet. There will be three tasks, and each recording will be played twice. The tasks will be given some music, and then you will hear, and you can also read, the instructions to the task. This will be followed by a silent period on the CD in order to give you some time to look at the task in your test booklet before hearing the text. Then, we will play the recording in one piece. After another short silent period, we will play the recording for a second time, but now in shorter sections and with breaks between the sections in order to give you enough time to write down your answers. Please note that the first item in each task, marked with a tick, is always an example. The whole test is exactly 30 minutes long. Good luck! Task 1. In this section, you will hear a radio report about what we might be putting on our plates in 20 years' time. Your task will be to circle the letter or letters of the correct answer or answers in the boxes on the right. Please note that in this task, both answers may be correct. This means that you will have to circle either A or B or both A and B. First, you will have some time to look at the task, and then we will play the whole recording in one piece. Then, after a short pause, you will hear the recording again, but this time we will play the text in shorter sections to give you enough time to write down your answers. Now, look at the task in your booklet. Now, listen to the recording.
Rising food prices, the growing population, and environment concerns are just a few issues that have organizations, including the United Nations and the British government, worrying about how we will feed ourselves in the future. It means that we have to rethink what we eat, says food futurologists. So what might we be serving in 20 years' time? Some in the food industry estimate meat prices could double in the next 5 to 7 years, making meat a luxury item. In the West, many of us have grown up with cheap, abundant meat, says food futurologist Morgan Gay. Rising prices mean we are now starting to see the return of meat as a luxury. As a result, we are looking for new ways to fill the meat gap. So what will fill such gaps in our stomachs, and how will we eat it? Insects will become a basic part of our diet, says Gay. It's a win-win situation. According to researchers, insects provide as much nutritional value as ordinary meat. They are high in protein, they contain iron and calcium, as well as vitamins A, B1, B2, and vitamin D, and edible insects are also considerably lower in fat than pork or beef. They also cost less to raise than cattle, consume less water, and do not have as much of a carbon footprint. Plus, there are an estimated 1,400 species that are edible to man. Gay is not talking about huge, whole bugs arriving on a plate near you. Insect burgers and sausages are likely to resemble their meat counterparts. Things like crickets and grasshoppers will be ground down and used as an ingredient in things like burgers. 2 billion people in the world, that means 1/3 of the population, already eat insects as a regular part of their diet. Caterpillars and locusts are popular in Africa, wasps are a delicacy in Japan, crickets are eaten in Thailand. But insects will need an image overhaul if they are to become more palatable to the squeamish Europeans and North Americans, says Gay. They will become popular when we get away from the word insects and use something like mini-livestock.
Now, listen to the recording again. Remember that this time we will play the recording in shorter sections.
Rising food prices, the growing population, and environment concerns are just a few issues that have organizations, including the United Nations and the British government, worrying about how we will feed ourselves in the future. It means that we have to rethink what we eat, says food futurologists. So what might we be serving in 20 years' time? Some in the food industry estimate meat prices could double in the next 5 to 7 years, making meat a luxury item. In the West, many of us have grown up with cheap, abundant meat, says food futurologist Morgane Gay. Rising prices mean we are now starting to see the return of meat as a luxury. As a result, we are looking for new ways to fill the meat gap. So what will fill such gaps in our stomachs, and how will we eat it? Insects will become a basic part of our diet, says Gay. It's a win-win situation. According to researchers, insects provide as much nutritional value as ordinary meat. They are high in protein, they contain iron and calcium, as well as vitamins A, B1, B2, and vitamin D, and edible insects are also considerably lower in fat than pork or beef. They also cost less to raise than cattle, consume less water, and do not have as much of a carbon footprint. Plus, there are an estimated 1,400 species that are edible to man. Gay is not talking about huge, whole bugs arriving on a plate near you. Insect burgers and sausages are likely to resemble their meat counterparts. Things like crickets and grasshoppers will be ground down and used as an ingredient in things like burgers. Two billion people in the world, that means 1/3 of the population, already eat insects as a regular part of their diet. Caterpillars and locusts are popular in Africa, wasps are a delicacy in Japan, crickets are eaten in Thailand. But insects will need an image overhaul if they are to become more palatable to the squeamish Europeans and North Americans, says Gay. They will become popular when we get away from the word insects and use something like mini-livestock.
That is the end of task one. Task two. In this section, you will hear an interview with Sarah Morgan, an American businesswoman who runs a speed dating service in London. Your task will be to decide whether the following statements are true, false, or we do not know because the text does not say, and write the appropriate letter in the boxes on the right. Write A if the statement is true, write B if the statement is false, and write C if the text does not say. First, you will have some time to look at the task, and then we will play the whole recording in one piece. Then, you will hear the recording again, but this time we will play the text in shorter sections to give you enough time to write down your answers. A means true, B means false, C means the text does not say. Now, look at the task in your booklet. Now, listen to the recording.
Hi, Sarah, and welcome to the studio. I hear you're running one of the largest speed dating services, Piccadilly SD, here in London. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have never heard of speed dating. Could you please first explain to us what it's all about?
Speed dating is a formalized matchmaking process or dating system whose purpose is to encourage people to meet a large number of new people. It is usually organized in a restaurant or a bar where men and women are rotated to meet each other over a series of short dates, brief chats usually lasting from 3 to 8 minutes, depending on the organization running the event. Actually, what usually happens is that the women sit down at one of the tables that are arranged in a line, and the men take turns to sit and talk to each woman. At the end of each interval, the organizer rings a bell, clinks a glass, or blows a whistle to signal the men to move on to the next date. At the end of the event, participants submit to the organizers a list of who they would like to provide their contact information to. If there is a match, email addresses are forwarded to both parties.
That sounds quite interesting. But how popular is it?
Well, as so many things, the idea came to Britain from the US. Well, not with me, of course, because we only started 2 years ago. I think the first such event took place at a cafe in Beverly Hills back in late 1998. It's become more and more popular, and there are lots of speed dating events in the United States, Canada, and now in the United Kingdom, too. Several speed dating events are targeted at particular communities. For example, for Christians, pensioners, or even for vegetarians only. Graduate student speed dating events are also more and more common.
And do you think it really works?
Well, some feel that speed dating has some obvious advantages over most other venues for meeting people, such as bars, discos, etc., in that everybody is supposedly there to meet someone. Unlike many bars, a speed dating event will, by necessity, be quite enough for people to talk comfortably. You know, speed dating is for singles, so it's a huge advantage that participants can come alone without feeling out of place. Alternatively, it's something that women who like to go out in groups can do together. Because the matching itself happens after the event, people do not feel pressured to select or reject each other in person.
But how? I mean, on what basis do people make their decisions about a partner in such a short time?
Well, the majority of participants say that the time is definitely enough to decide that someone is not your type, and thus you can eliminate the really hopeless cases. A 2006 study in Edinburgh, Scotland showed that 45% of the women participants in a speed dating event and 22% of the men had come to a decision within the first 30 seconds.
Is there any scientific evidence about the typical first impression preferences of women and men?
Well, a 2006 study at the University of Essex into these questions shows that a woman's age is the single most important factor determining demand by men, closely followed by how pretty her face is. Although less important than it is to men, age is still a highly significant factor determining demand by women, but facial features seem to be much less important for them. The same study found, however, that a man's height had the most significant impact upon his desirability for women, with a reduction in height causing a decrease in desirability at a rate of 5% per inch. It also found that dialogue concerning travel resulted in more matches than dialogue about films.
Now, listen to the recording again. Remember that this time we will play the recording in shorter sections.
Hi, Sarah, and welcome to the studio. I hear you're running one of the largest speed dating services, Piccadilly SD, here in London. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have never heard of speed dating. Could you please first explain to us what it's all about?
Speed dating is a formalized matchmaking process or dating system whose purpose is to encourage people to meet a large number of new people. It is usually organized in a restaurant or a bar where men and women are rotated to meet each other over a series of short dates, brief chats, usually lasting from 3 to 8 minutes, depending on the organization running the event. Actually, what usually happens is that the women sit down at one of the tables that are arranged in a line, and the men take turns to sit and talk to each woman. At the end of each interval, the organizer rings a bell, clinks a glass, or blows a whistle to signal the men to move on to the next date. At the end of the event, participants submit to the organizers a list of who they would like to provide their contact information to. If there is a match, email addresses are forwarded to both parties.
That sounds quite interesting. But how popular is it?
Well, as so many things, the idea came to Britain from the US. Well, not with me, of course, because we only started 2 years ago. I think the first such event took place at a cafe in Beverly Hills back in late 1998. It's become more and more popular, and there are lots of speed dating events in the United States, Canada, and now in the United Kingdom, too. Several speed dating events are targeted at particular communities. For example, for Christians, pensioners, or even for vegetarians only. Graduate student speed dating events are also more and more common.
And do you think it really works?
Well, some feel that speed dating has some obvious advantages over most other venues for meeting people, such as bars, discos, etc., in that everybody is supposedly there to meet someone. Unlike many bars, a speed dating event will, by necessity, be quite enough for people to talk comfortably. You know, speed dating is for singles, so it's a huge advantage that participants can come alone without feeling out of place. Alternatively, it's something that women who like to go out in groups can do together. Because the matching itself happens after the event, people do not feel pressured to select or reject each other in person.
But how? I mean, on what basis do people make their decisions about a partner in such a short time?
Well, the majority of participants say that the time is definitely enough to decide that someone is not your type, and thus you can eliminate the really hopeless cases. A 2006 study in Edinburgh, Scotland showed that 45% of the women participants in a speed dating event and 22% of the men had come to a decision within the first 30 seconds.
Is there any scientific evidence about the typical first impression preferences of women and men?
Well, a 2006 study at the University of Essex into these questions shows that a woman's age is the single most important factor determining demand by men, closely followed by how pretty her face is. Although less important than it is to men, age is still a highly significant factor determining demand by women. But facial features seem to be much less important for them. The same study found, however, that a man's height had the most significant impact upon his desirability for women, with a reduction in height causing a decrease in desirability at a rate of 5% per inch. It also found that dialogue concerning travel resulted in more matches than dialogue about films.
That is the end of Task 2. Task 3. In this section, you will hear about the problem of an elderly woman and some other people living in Herne Bay, a seaside town in England. Your task will be to complete the sentences with the exact words you hear in the text. Write one word in each gap, that is, two words in each item. First, you will have some time to study the task, and then we will play the whole recording in one piece. Then, you will hear the recording again, but this time we will play the text in shorter sections to give you enough time to write down your answers. Now, look at the task in your booklet. Now, listen to the recording.
Hello and good morning. You are listening to Radio Bridge 102.5 and I'm Peter Smith. It's nothing new that birds can be a pain, but one woman in England has a story we've certainly never heard before. Dina Wilson from Herne Bay has been dive-bombed by a seagull nesting in her roof. The attack on Mrs. Wilson happened after a chick had fallen out of its nest into the garden. She did not notice it, and its mother swooped down to attack her. When she went out in the garden again, it dived at her again and again. One attack even drew blood as the creature pecked the 71-year-old scalp. Mrs. Wilson said,
"I had to go around my garden with a colander on my head to get the washing off the line. We've got grandchildren, and while an attack on an adult is bad, it's another thing with a child. It could be quite scary for them."
The 71-year-old grandmother is now asking town councillors in Herne Bay to consider steps that would prevent people from feeding the gulls and would also require restaurants to cover their rubbish, which seagulls take much pleasure in devouring. She said,
"Businesses need to be more careful and people should stop feeding the birds. If you go down the high street early in the morning, all the takeaway shops have their rubbish out in purple plastic bags. They are full of chips and leftovers and the seagulls rip them open and have a wonderful feast. The easy solution would be for the council to provide boxes to businesses to put their bags in, and that will be the end of the story."
Councillors will discuss what to do about the problem at a meeting in the town tonight. Councillor Ron Flaherty will ask the council to produce a report on the issues of seagulls on the coast at the Herne Bay Area Member Panel meeting. He said,
"There are a number of residents telling me that they are being attacked by seagulls in their back gardens, simply because the gulls are nesting near their houses on their chimneys. It's not just on the coast, but inland as well. The problem is clear. We're not helping ourselves by allowing both residents and visitors to feed the seagulls. From what I gather, other coastal areas have laws made by local authorities preventing it, and people who do feed gulls face fines. If this is an approach that works, then it should be looked at. When somebody in Herne Bay drops a chip, you get 50 or 100 seagulls descend on it. There is poo all over the pavement and all over cars. It's horrendous. These gulls are scavengers. They're not to be fed."
Now, Councillor Ron Flaherty seems to have a very strong opinion on this issue. Whether the other councillors in Herne Bay agree with him or not, we just have to wait and see.
Now, listen to the recording again. Remember that this time we will play the recording in shorter sections.
Hello and good morning. You are listening to Radio Bridge 102.5 and I'm Peter Smith. It's nothing new that birds can be a pain, but one woman in England has a story we've certainly never heard before. Dina Wilson from Herne Bay has been dive-bombed by a seagull nesting in her roof. The attack on Mrs. Wilson happened after a chick had fallen out of its nest into the garden. She did not notice it, and its mother swooped down to attack her. When she went out in the garden again, it dived at her again and again. One attack even drew blood as the creature pecked the 71-year-old's scalp. Mrs. Wilson said,
I had to go around my garden with a colander on my head to get the washing off the line. We've got grandchildren, and while an attack on an adult is bad, it's another thing with a child. It could be quite scary for them.
The 71-year-old grandmother is now asking town councillors in Herne Bay to consider steps that would prevent people from feeding the gulls and would also require restaurants to cover their rubbish, which seagulls take much pleasure in devouring. She said,
Businesses need to be more careful and people should stop feeding the birds. If you go down the high street early in the morning, all the takeaway shops have their rubbish out in purple plastic bags. They are full of chips and leftovers, and the seagulls rip them open and have a wonderful feast. The easy solution would be for the council to provide boxes to businesses to put their bags in, and that would be the end of the story.
Councillors will discuss what to do about the problem at a meeting in the town tonight. Councillor Ron Flaherty will ask the council to produce a report on the issues of seagulls on the coast at the Herne Bay Area Member Panel meeting. He said,
There are a number of residents telling me that they are being attacked by seagulls in their back gardens, simply because the gulls are nesting near their houses on their chimneys. It's not just on the coast, but inland as well. The problem is clear. We're not helping ourselves by allowing both residents and visitors to feed the seagulls. From what I gather, other coastal areas have laws made by local authorities preventing it, and people who do feed gulls face fines. If this is an approach that works, then it should be looked at. When somebody in Herne Bay drops a chip, you get 50 or 100 seagulls descend on it. There is poo all over the pavement and all over cars. It's horrendous. These gulls are scavengers. They're not to be fed.
Now, Councillor Ron Flaherty seems to have a very strong opinion on this issue. Whether the other councillors in Herne Bay agree with him or not, we just have to wait and see.
That is the end of task 3 and also the end of the listening exam.